You're listening to the Corner House podcast. Visit the Corner House website for listings and more.
Hello and welcome to the first Corner House podcast of the new year. I'm Sarah Perks, Programme and Engagement Director here at Corner House. Coming up, we'll be reviewing the artist, Michael Hazanavicius' new silent film that's got everybody talking. You'll also hear more about our up-and-coming Gallery One group exhibition, Lost is Found. And artist-turned-filmmaker Steve McQueen will be answering your questions on his new film, Shame. And have an announcement. This podcast is going to switch from weekly to monthly editions, so we'll be giving you a rundown of must-see art, film, and even more stuff taking place at Corner House all through January. Okay, it's time for our film focus, The Artist. This is a much-hyped new film. It's set in 1927. The star is George Valentin. He's a silent movie star. He's the most famous there is, based on a sort of Douglas Fairbanks-like character. That is until the arrival of sound comes along and threatens his career. There's three main characters in this film. The second is Peppy Miller, who's a young starlet slash film fan, and she starts to breathe new life into the studio and take lots of main roles as sound becomes much more popular. And there's also a third character that we'll come back to, and it is, of course, Oogie the dog. So first off, Andy, give us your first reactions to this film.
Well, I think it's one of those films that has been hyped so much, you're expecting something, you know, absolutely mind-blowing, out of this world. And I wasn't blown away by the film, but it is an incredibly enjoyable hour and a half in the cinema. So, I wasn't quite as taken as most people seem to be. What did you make of it?
Absolutely loved this film. It's not one for kind of technical and genre subversion and something that's blown away, but it's completely enjoyable in a what's still a five-star kind of way. I loved every minute. I was laughing out loud, wanted to clap along. I loved the fact that it's a silent film with a little bit of sound, but you didn't notice. People are like, oh no, I don't know if I can watch a silent film. It's got a score, it's got music going on all the time. It's not that you're sat in absolute silence wondering whether you're making strange noises in your cinema seat. It's just a really enjoyable ride. All the lead characters are fantastic, and of course there's one standout role who needs to get the Oscar, and that is of course Oogie the dog.
Well, I believe that there's a campaign now in some of the press to get Oogie the dog a Best Supporting Actor nomination for the Oscars, which I think would be quite a good thing if something like that happened. I mean, I found it a kind of tour de force of style, you know, recreating the old film look, using the old Academy ratio. Everything was really detailed. But for me, that was just, it was nothing more than an exercise in style. It was entertaining enough, but I didn't come out of it thinking I'd learnt anything more about silent filmmaking than, say, watching Singing in the Rain, which I have to say I felt was actually a kind of a bit more razor sharp in its dissection of that era of cinema.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is in that group of films of Singing in the Rain, without a doubt. And it referenced lots of films. It does reference some of the big classics of silent film, and obviously referencing some of the stars of that period, most obviously Douglas Fairbanks. But it also references things like Citizen Kane and Hitchcock as well. So it's sort of, it's one of those love stories to film, but it's really well done. They can come out as sometimes quite poor films and a little bit too kind of gimmicky or based on a kind of fan's opinion of that period. But this doesn't. This just works as a beautifully crafted, solid, fun film experience that I think everyone needs to see. What about the director, Andy? What do you know about him?
Well, I'm not going to try and say his name because you've done such a good effort at that. But I do know that he's got kind of form, if you like, with this kind of recreating earlier types of films. He directed two films about OSS 117, the kind of French Secret Service spy films that are pastiches of 1950s and 1960s Euro spy films, one set in Cairo and one set in Rio. And they really use, you know, that old film stock. They look like they were shot at the time. And so it's something I think that for the artist, he's been honing his skills at recreating previous styles of cinema. So it's not out of the blue. I mean, this is one of the things with the artist, I think. It kind of been talked about as if he suddenly appeared out of the blue. But as I say, he's already worked on this style of film before, if not silent films. And those films also starred Jean Dujardin as well, who's the star of The Artist. So I think they're going to become a real collaborative pair that we have to look out for in the future.
It's also worth remembering that this it's sort of a French film, although I'm sure there's American money in the film. But of course, it's a silent film, so it doesn't matter. It's nice to hark back to that period of time when you didn't even know where films were from in the world. People get so obsessed with foreign language films and things. But actually, if you go back, film was a universal medium because, of course, there was no language barriers to overcome in the beginning. And although it's a French film, it is shot in LA. I mean, it's a film about Hollywood, absolutely. So you've got all the various recognizable locations going on in the film as well. And some cameos from people like John Goodman and Malcolm McDowell even pops up as well. So that's The Artist. It's going to screen until at least Thursday, the 19th of January, possibly longer, and possibly one of those films that will come back when it wins all the awards. So check our website for full screening times and to watch the trailer. This weekend, we have a new exhibition opening called Lost is Found, and it's a group show that features the work of 9 artists based at Manchester's Rogue Studios, Liverpool's The Royal Standard, and Sheffield's S1 Art Space. The great thing about the show, it's been curated by our creative stars, so they're Cornish young people, they're aged roughly around 17 to 19, and they're going to tell us a bit more about the show.
Hello, I'm Oliver Jones, and I'm one of the creative stars here at Corner House. We've curated and developed a new exhibition, Lost is Found, starting showing from Saturday the 14th of January. I'm here with the rest of the marketing team, Lisa, Karis, Adal and Liam. So, how did you start off the process of the exhibition?
So, our curated team went to art studios. They went to about 5 in the north of England and looked at about 200 different artists' work, which they then shortlisted to about 50 and then found like a running theme and sort of similar themes throughout those works. And then they finally took 9 artists, which were their favourites from all the ones which they looked at, which are now the 9 which we're going to have in our exhibition.
The themes included things like rebirth, redundant and discarded objects given new life, identity and also transformations.
Now, as Lisa said, there are 9 artists in the exhibition Lost is Found, and I've got my favourite, Andrea Booker. And Andrea Booker was born in Barnsley in 1971, and she lives and works in Manchester. And her work is all about reclaimed and demolished and refurbished buildings in Manchester, specifically the signs of the buildings. So she takes the signs and then she creates new words, and that just fitted in really well with the exhibition. So Liam, what's your favourite artist?
My favourite is John Barakoff's work, which is some of the only drawn pieces in the selection, and it really adds a new dimension to the exhibition. His work looks into our purpose as human beings and several themes of identity. This is all done through fine line drawings.
So me and Liam have said our favourite artists, so how about you, Adal?
My favourite piece is by Emily Speed. It's called Egg Nest Home Country Universe, and it's cast plaster shelves supporting small architecture, and they look like small buildings just balanced on the egg. What I like about this is I think it's one of the most imaginative and creative pieces in the show, and I think it really makes you intrigued and makes you wonder what like the true meaning and why Emily wanted to make a house with an egg on it.
Yeah, I agree. They're a really intriguing part of the exhibition. So, Karis, what's your favourite artist?
My favourite artist is Lucy Ridges, and she was one of the photographers in the exhibition. She was born in the south of England in 1984, and she practised photography from her studio space in Rogue Studios. Lucy's photographic practice is visual expression of our everyday thoughts and subconscious mind. The images she creates are scenes of senseless human interaction, and I think that's interesting and it's my favourite because it's different to other artists' work and photographers' work, and it's good to be different.
And coincidentally, Karis, Lisa Ridges actually works here at the Corner House. So moving on, Lisa, what's your favourite artist?
Well, my favourite artist has definitely got to be Richard Prophet. He was born and lives in Liverpool, and his work, which we're featuring in our exhibition, is called Louisiana Blues Anywhere. Richard's basically taken a moped, which is so fragile and beyond repair that you actually can't sit on it. And he's attached like all these weird and wonderful things to it and basically made it into a piece of art, which is really nice because it fits in with the theme of our exhibition, which is rebirth.
So don't forget to wander into an illusion where the lost is found from Saturday the 14th of January to Sunday the 19th of February here in Gallery 1 at the Corner House. The exhibition is totally free and it's featuring artists John Barraclough, Mark Beecroft, Andrea Booker, Eileen O'Rourke, Jessica Fairbrother, Richard Prophet, Lucy Ridges, Emily Speed and Cherry Tennyson.
So thanks very much to Oliver and the team. So you can join us for a glimpse of the show. The preview is Saturday, the 14th of January, 5 p.m. till 7 p.m, so it's free to drop in. The exhibition's on for a month. And you can also catch some of the artists involved, Emily Speed, Eileen O'Rourke and Jessa Fairbrother, hosting a free exhibition tour on Sunday, the 15th of January, so it's definitely worth checking that out. For more information about the exhibition and any events, go to cornerhouse.org/art.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast. Available to download every month from the Corner House website.
It's now time for our What's On. So looking across this month of January 2012. On Tuesday the 17th of January, Julie Meyer's going to be here. She's one of the BBC Dragon's Den online stars. And she's delivering the latest in our series of keynotes. Here's Isabel Croissant, our programme manager for creative industries, to tell us a little bit more.
Julie Meyer is one of the most prominent female entrepreneurs in the UK. She set up and ran Ariadne Capital, which is an investment advisory firm for entrepreneurs in technology and new media. If you need example of her amazing track record, you may be familiar with the name lastminute.com or Skype. Well, she was involved in their go-to-market deals. And of course, you may also be familiar with her as she's one of the dragons on the BBC's Dragon's Den online. For this keynote, she will be joined by her colleague David Schultz. Both of them have considerable experience in advising new media and technology entrepreneurs on their go-to-market strategy, helping them raise capital to achieve their goals, and also project managing their deals. This might sound scarily impressive, but they are also highly experienced inspirational speakers, and in their keynote, they will share their years of experience and look at what the creative sector can learn from technology successes, how to build bridges and forge connection with the technology, media and analysis sector. Basically, how the creative sector can plug into experiences from the technology one to make themselves more attractive to investors, but also to the whole technology ecosystem in general.
Now, we've also got Ralph Fiennes' directorial debut, Coriolanus, and that opens on Friday, the 20th of January. And here I've got Corner House Chief Exec Dave Mutry telling us what we can expect from this modern adaptation of the Shakespearean classic.
Okay, so Coriolanus is about a soldier in Rome who basically falls out with the people who are running Rome, leaves Rome, joins up with the baddies, comes back and attacks Rome. And it's that story, basically. Coriolanus is the person who's the subject of it all. That's a role taken by Ralph Fiennes in this film, who also directs it and sets it as sort of a modern dress thing, but set in an Eastern European state, in a state of war. It's a fantastic performance from Fiennes. He's not alone. There are other good performances throughout the film. It's fast-moving, well-paced and sticks pretty well to the story and uses the Elizabethan language. But it's a great film. It's well worth watching. I highly recommend it.
Now, if live literature's your thing, get to Afflecks Palace for the three-minute theatre event on Monday, the 23rd of January, when Michael Stewart, who is the winner of 2010's Not the Booker Prize, will be leading the lineup. Search the New Libertines on Facebook to find out more about this. On Thursday the 26th of January, you need to head down to Islington Mill for the second annual Manchester Artist Bonfire, when artists and curators will consign their work to the flames in the name of art. Sounds good. I'm sure I can contribute something there. See islingtonmill.com for more details. Don't miss your last chance to see Bethany Gray's distinctive paintings here at Corner House, showing as part of our Corner House project until Tuesday the 31st of January. Here's Thomas Harold, he's our exhibitions coordinator, to explain about it.
Bethany Gray is a very talented young artist from Cheshire. She graduated just last summer from Fine Art at Manchester Metropolitan University, which is where we saw her work. Really impressed with her massive canvases. Absolutely beautiful looking paintings taken from natural scenes. Her way of working is really interesting. She works on site, initially taking lots of drawings, and then progressively reworks each image over and over by redrawing it and repainting it until it becomes quite transformed and more about her memory of the place and an actual representation of the real place. All of her work's for sale, ranges in prices. And it's an opportunity to buy a young artist's work who's just at the beginning of her career, already with a couple of prizes under her belt. So her exhibition finishes at the end of the month on Tuesday the 31st of January, and it takes place across the cafe bar on both floors.
And last but certainly not least, join us on Sunday the 29th of January when we'll be screening the latest film in our new British cinema quarterly strand. The film is called Patience, and then in brackets, After Sibbald. It's about the author, who you may be familiar with his book, The Rings of Saturn. And it's followed by a Q&A with the filmmaking team. Bren O'Callaghan has already had a sneak preview of the film, so let's hear from him.
So, Patience After Sibbald is a really unusual mashup, and I would tell people not to be too concerned about what they might read about it, because it's been described as a richly textured film essay, but it's actually very poetic, and equally that might put some people off. It's directed by a guy called Grant Gee, who's better known for making music videos for people like Blur and Badly Drawn Boy, and so that he should be tackling a topic like this is really surprising, but he does it very well. It responds to a book that was written by an academic, and this book was called The Rings of Saturn, and generally it's about a guy who goes on a walk around East Anglia, which sounds thrilling, I know, but while he's on this walk, and this is something he really did, he starts musing about the places that he's visiting and the people he's remembering, and he'll link places to quite significant global, worldwide events. And it's a book that only came out a few years before 2000, but famously has developed a cult following, and people try and recreate this very same walk, this same journey, and that's what the filmmaker's doing. So as not to give too much away, it's very much an introduction to the author of this book, the book itself, the journey, but it's a really gorgeous, beautiful film. It's very poetic, it's very soft, it's very light, and there's a very deliberate intention to present the images in certain ways. So it's almost like going to see an art installation, but this is in a cinema. So I would strongly recommend it, in the sense that this is a director that people had previously categorised as working only in music, and he's now working in feature film. It's a very unusual feature film. You feel like you're on this journey yourself, and it's a really accessible and interesting introduction to what could be otherwise quite a challenging topic, an academic walking around East Anglia.
At the end of last year, we were really lucky in the fact that we had director Steve McQueen here. Following his first film, Hunger, he brought us his second directorial film called Shame, starring Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan, and the film centres on the controversial subject of sex addiction. After the preview, Steve took your questions from the audience, so if you were unlucky and missed out on that event, here's your chance to hear what Steve had to say about the film.
How did you go about the process of writing it with Abby? So you're both credited as co-writers. Did you spend a lot of time together? Did you go your separate ways and come back? How did you write it?
Abby is a very close friend of mine. It was just such a great bond. Our egos went out the window, and it was all about the actual job of creating the story. So after we decided, okay, we want to make the story, we wanted to sort of talk to people who had, you know, who were sex addicts in London. But we couldn't find anyone to speak to. No one would talk to us. And I think at the time the Tiger Woods thing happened, so it was huge in the press. And of course, the British media as it is, no one really wanted to speak to us. So it was very difficult to sort of get an in on the subject matter. All these doors were being sort of shut in our faces. So it was similar to sort of Miss Marple and Columbo. We sort of blunderingly went off to New York in a way that we got in contact with two experts in the field who then talked to us. We had a week in New York to do research. They introduced us to people who had the affliction and had the addiction, because we went out to talk to them for like 3 days, which was very heavy, because of course when I first heard about sex addiction, like most people, you laugh. But then you sort of see what it actually entails. I mean, it's like the drunk at the Christmas party. That when you find out this person, to get through a day, is drinking a bottle of vodka or more, it ceases to become funny.
Just sticking with sex addiction for the moment, for me, there's something really that comes out quite powerfully in this film about trauma in the kind of psychological, personal sense, mm-hmm. and how it really affects people's, particularly Brandon's perception of reality and like rationality. He sort of begins to lose grip on what's actually rational and won't take responsibility. It's like he kind of has this daily ritual, but he's not really there. How did you kind of develop that character?
A lot of people who are living in that world who have decided for themselves, you know, they work, they make money, but they create an environment for themselves, which is sort of what they want. And it's very central, centered to themselves. I mean, again, I think with sexual addiction, it's been sort of, you know, again, it's been facilitated, of course, very much, of course, by the internet. You know, you could click, you know, some 12-year-old kid could two buttons on his iPod, and have the most explicit sexual images. I mean, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, I imagine similar to how you, most people here, you know, it was on the top shelf of a news agent. That's as near as you got to it. Or that guy who brought the sex magazine to school and everyone huddled around. Now, you know, his pornography has never been more easily accessible. I mean, I don't know if it's good or bad, I have no idea. So therefore, it's one of those situations where I just was very much interested in that world where someone, you know, also, you know, can isolate themselves into create this world for themselves. This happens all the time. You know, it's very now. People create their own environment. That's how they do it. That's what they want.
Let's talk about the cast a little bit. So Michael Fassbender, how central was he to the film for you? Was there someone else, or did you only imagine that he could play this
Michael,
role?
Michael, with Hunger, we made a relationship with Hunger. That was it, really. I thought, you know, well, Michael's the guy for this. And I think Michael is a tour de force in the movie. But also he's a focus, he's a concentration. And we work very quick together, so it's very easy, in a way, to work together. That's great. And I would sort of, he would do something on camera that wouldn't be exactly what I wanted, and I would walk up to him before I reached him. He'd say, yeah, I know, okay. Right, I walk back to the camera, so that'll be it. So, and sometimes, of course, the preparation with Michael is the beginning to talk about the film and the script. He gets the script. He also reads the script. He reads the script about 300 times. He just reads the script. So therefore, then we have conversations about it, and he actually met a few people who had the affliction of sex, who were sex addicts. And then, you know, we talk about the character. I did 2 days of rehearsal with him, Michael, Kerry Mulligan, James Badge Dell, and it was too good. So we did 2 days, and I said, stop, we've got to stop this now. Put the plane back on the tarmac, because it got to be so good. I thought, okay, we have to forget it, no more rehearsals. So thank God I wrote notes about all the rehearsals we did, implied them into the script, but it was a month before we were shooting, so it was wonderful. By that time, they had forgotten what they had done. So I implemented it in the script, but they could recharge the batteries again. As far as working with actors are concerned, which with actors, I very much have to know the actor, because I don't want to hire actors. I want to work with them. And hiring actors, I mean, they just, you know, come and do the lines and that's it. I'm not interested. It has a real sort of connection. Otherwise,
collaboration.
What's the point?
And was there much improvisation, or is it all scripted?
There was a lot of improvisation in a way, but the script, that's the basis. I mean, it's all there. I mean, it's all in the script. You see, we describe it's like, you know, an and if is out, or if and a but is in. You know, I don't like it. Sometimes things have to be perfect, but other times they could be much more looser, as long as it can communicate better than possibly the script. If it isn't better than the script, we stick to the script. That's it.
Hi, Steve. I thought it was a stunning film, so I'm really thrilled to be able to be here.
Great.
To see it. I just wanted to ask you about the editing process. Watching films, I tend to get really obsessive about really minor details that may or may not have been intended. So there was one particular cut that I wanted to ask about. When he goes out for a jog while his sister is with Dave in his apartment, he stops at a crossroad, and there's a flicker of light from a passing truck or something.
Yeah.
And then the cut into his apartment,
yeah,
as he hits the light switch, there's that flicker of light also from the overhead strip.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether that was an intentional decision to kind of make that a transition from the flickering light.
It was. But what happened when you see the stop sign and it's broken, it's fallen down, of course, what happened, there was, a taco truck there, and we were asked it to be moved, and it hit the light, and it just fell down. So it was great. I thought, fantastic. So it was a great accident, of course. And so stop meaning go, and go meaning stop. So when he's still jogging on the spot, ready to cross the street, and the flicker was, that was sort of part of that. A lamppost was sort of, you know, at that moment, which is beautiful. All these sort of accidents, sometimes you're wonderful to embrace.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I loved it.
Hi, I wanted to ask you about something that's been touched on a couple of times, the background, but in relation to kind of character development. I'm not trying to pin you down to tell
please,
me what it
please
was.
Please do.
Oh, I don't want you to tell me what their backgrounds was, were, but in relation to kind of the actors, obviously the script, when you wrote it with Abby Morgan, you must have had an idea of it or something.
Kind of an idea, not specific.
And when obviously they read the script for the first time, it's quite a sparse script, really, in some ways, because it's not laden with dialogue. In a sense, watching it, I thought if I was to read that, I could be very open to kind of character development. How much was their kind of relation to the script kind of developed with you in terms of background? Did you kind of like take on their ideas on board? Or were you kind of,
no.
Did you give them a strong idea of where they were coming from?
Okay, no was the answer to that question. The script wasn't sparse at all, at all, in fact. And hopefully you read a copy of it. It's very literal. Sometimes you have to describe the abstract. You can't allow for interpretation because, in some ways, therefore there's no script. There's no story. You know, you have to sort of describe the abstract. For example, the New York piece, every single verse, the interpretation, the pauses, the sort of, you know, what possibly is going on at that moment is written. Everything is written, you know. And I think with the background, you talk about the background with the individual actors and what possibly happened in their background, then you move on. Situation with that is that I didn't want to get into any kind of specific detail about what caused Brandon to be who he is. Possibly he just likes, you know, sex, where he has that thing in him where he's compulsed to have sex. It doesn't have to be some sort of traumatic thing that happened to his past. You had to be open, because in some ways there wasn't any specific one thing that we discovered why people had a particular sort of addiction to sex. Yes, there was a lot of people who had a traumatic past with the parents, absolutely, or whatever. Notice that we never mentioned the parents, for example, in the whole film. No one ever says anything about, you know, mum and dad or the parent, or, you know, not, no one ever. So it was one of those things where everything has to be sort of written. There are a lot of movies going on. I want to make a film, meaning that, you know, as soon as you walk in, you, okay, I know what's going to happen here, I know what's going to happen there. But in real life, that doesn't happen. In real life, I just wanted to make a story, but a film which was all about what was happening at this present moment in time. And these characters, you know, are who they are. You know, they're not talking to shrinks or talking to their best friend about what they do. They're internalizing everything.
Just want to say what a fantastic film it was. There's three scenes where it's just an awful lot of music, like the opening scene. And would love to ask you, first of all, about where did you find Harry Escott? Because that was just one hell of a score. So it was absolutely blinding. And when she's doing New York, New York, it stays with it for about, what is it, a good 4 or 5 minutes. Now, you must have people chewing your ear off going, come on. Because in that, she's expressing a vulnerability. And it just says so much. And I just want to say, what a brave fellow you are. But do you ever get the, right, we haven't had any dialogue here for a wee bit, so it might be time to kick in something, or people telling you any of that?
No, that's gone. I think, Harry, I start the first thing. Harry is just amazing composer. And, you know, we talked a lot about the music to get it right. And he's just a sensitive person, wonderful sensibility. I mean, I haven't met any composers before then, because we'd hung, I worked with one fantastic Northern Irish composer. So with Harry, it was just one of those things where, because it was more to do with the image and stuff, and just talking to him about what I wanted and stuff, and he was amazing. He has a certain sensibility. And we went and recorded in Abbey Road with a full orchestra, so that was, for me, it was a big high, you know, that was just amazing. He has a certain kind of sensibility. The other question was to do with people chewing my ear for doing certain things. I've got time for that, you know what I mean? I just, you know, again, I think, you know, I'm not interested in adaptating books or TV shows or anything like that. I'm not here to illustrate anything. I'm here to sort of try and make something. And also, but what was for me very important about this particular subject matter, it was not being spoken about or talked about or given any kind of sort of platform. It was something like hunger, which is swept underneath the carpet. So a lot of people, I feel, are kind of uneasy about the film because it's sort of so direct, and it's about some guy who doesn't have contact with many people. Go figure, this happens a lot. So I think, you know, there was license for me to do what I wanted to do with it. As long as I don't bore people, I think that's for me very important.
Hi, Steve. I'm really fascinated by your use of, like, the long takes within the film. I was just wondering, why you choose it.
It's all about the story, what the story needs, what the story wants. I mean, you know, again, long takes. Okay, the running, I suppose, is the longest, one of the longest, or Carrie singing. Stay in the moment. And if it's giving you everything you want, you know, with Brandon running, for example, it gives us New York. We're outside, you know, and we got Brandon sort of in his head. So we get two things. We got this and we got that. It just sort of contracts. Sissy, we've got, you know, all the emotion on her face. You know, we don't want to cut. You've got everything there. You know, and as an audience, when her face is that close to you, she's singing. You could tell her she's lying. You could tell her she's not. You know, has feelings, you know, and it's acting at its highest order. When the camera's like that in your face like that, you have to deliver. It's pretty amazing. So what Kerry Mulligan has done. So, you know, those kind of things, what are the long takes? For example, the elevator, to hold attention before, we go into a situation of seeing the Sissy sort of, you know, when she attempts to commit suicide, to hold attention. You know, in the elevator, usually the cat, he's out, you know, to hold it. You know, it's kind of uncomfortable. It's kind of, you know, and for the actor too, but stay in the moment. So you're thinking, you're having tension too. What's he going to find? What's going to happen? You know, sometimes this cut business, it's not, for me, for this film, it's not the best thing. Maybe other films it will be, but to hold attention for me was very, very important. And that's it. It's just simple. It's very simple. Nothing genius about that.
So that was Steve McQueen's Shame, and it screens here from Friday the 13th of January. All the times and everything you need is on our website. Don't forget, you can book your tickets online with no extra booking fee. So we hope you've enjoyed this month's podcast, and you can find out more information on everything by visiting cornerhouse.org. If you want quick updates, why not follow us on Twitter? It's @cornerhousemcr, or like our Facebook page. And don't forget, you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Join us next month when we'll hear from British artist Samantha Donnelly on her up-and-coming solo show, Contour States. Also, following his 2004 hit Sideways, Alexander Payne returns with his new film, The Descendants, starring the lovely George Clooney, so we'll be reviewing that for you. And we'll also be talking about Exposures, the UK's largest festival of student film and moving image, which takes place here at the end of February.
You've been listening to the Corner House podcast. Visit the Corner House website for listings and more.